The New Quantum Era,
a podcast
by Sebastian Hassinger
and Kevin Roney. Hi, yeah. So I think this interview with James Wooten was a kind of a memorable conversation for me because of his wide ranging interests in a big swath of different topics, including the fascinating growing quantum computing hobbyist community out there. Also, James's passion for education and pedagogy and outreach. That's a mission that I believe, I think Sebastian does as well in the QC domain. And finally, he got into some really interesting deep material on quantum error correction, error mitigation, and this fascinating bit of math called the threshold theorem. So I really enjoyed this one.
Yeah, me too. Me too, Kevin. I really like James. I first became aware of James, as I mentioned this in the conversation, through his postings on quantum games, which I found fascinating, the idea of using quantum computers for gaming. You know, gaming has been, game development has been sort of an early adopter of almost every new technology that comes along. And I think it's because the spirit of play is a really effective way to both provide an entry point. As you said, he's really interested in education and bringing people into the community, but also experimenting with, you know, novel approaches and really not taking the current assumptions as givens and experimenting with around the edges of what, you know, people think is possible or feasible or correct areas of focus. And I think that's the other fascinating thing about James, is that the interesting interplay between that gaming and pedagogical area of interest with his sort of professional area of passion, which is quantum error correction, which is an extremely esoteric, complicated problem to solve with a bunch of potential solutions, but no clear winner, just like qubits themselves.
Right.
So we get into that a little bit, and I think that was a really interesting introduction to a topic that I'm sure we're going to revisit with future episodes as well. So I really enjoyed it too.
Good stuff. Well, without further ado, here we go.
Today, we're going to be talking with James Wooten. And James, you want to start by introducing yourself?
I'm James Wooten. I work for IBM Quantum, and I have the background of having a PhD in the field and working on it in research for many years. So mostly my research has been on quantum error correction. But also, I'm very interested in sort of education and outreach. And in fact, even before I joined IBM Quantum, I was involved in some outreach projects. And that's kind of why I gravitated towards IBM Quantum, because they were the ones putting the devices on the cloud at that time, which I thought was a really exciting thing. So I guess that's
I knew of you before you joined IBM because of explorations of sort of game development using the public IBM cloud quantum system. So that was probably, like, I think you made some Medium posts or something about that very early on, right?
Yeah. So, well, like, the long story is I was in Arosa, which is the birthplace of quantum mechanics, where Schrödinger came up with the wave equation. And I had this idea to make a game based on my research to be the heart of an outreach project. So that's what I was doing in 2016. And that's the kind of mindset I was in when IBM put devices on the cloud. So I was straight away thinking, well, I should make a game that runs on these. And then not so much because it's, you know, an example of quantum advantage and everyone's going to be falling over themselves to use this in the game industry. But yeah, as you said, it could be the heart of a blog. You could have a blog saying, I made a very simple game. This is how I made it. And then therefore demystify using quantum computers a little bit.
Yeah, you recently tweeted about, I think it was in response to somebody else, pointing out that the early days of classical computing were largely about appealing to hobbyists, right? Like Apple's first computer was essentially for hobbyists, and Microsoft's first products were for hobbyists, Basic in particular. And you responded, I think, saying you expected hobbyists to be, or the field to be more accessible by hobbyists, I guess is the way you would put it, right?
Yeah. So like, even going back to the 50s and 60s, it wasn't so much hobbyists, I suppose, because you had to have a certain status to have access to a computer. But the way people were using it was very much like the hacking culture that we saw later on. People were very interested to push these devices as far as they could. And so I expect that there should be a passion for people to do the same thing with quantum computing as well.
That always feels like a vital part of any sort of like rising tech movement is if there's a subculture of people who are really actively playing a really involved and creative way with pushing the edge on even economically irrational outcomes, but still they're just delightful intellectually or just socially. It's such a formidable area, though. I mean, quantum computing for hobbyists to get into. I mean, if you're already mathematically inclined, it's not an easy walk in the park to get up on this material. So, I mean, it's interesting to contemplate how maybe there's other routes of entry on pedagogy for this material.
Yeah, like certainly the kind of theory that we've been doing in quantum computing and in the theory behind making the devices and also using the devices is quite abstract, and it's not something that a hobbyist can easily pick up.
Yeah.
But the people who were making the early computers, they were using methodology, which is not what we do now when we use a computer.
Yes.
So if we can get people to get doing some of the minimal things that are interesting, then they might be able to find new ways into the field, ones that we, with more experience, never thought about, and therefore find ways to use it which are more accessible. So I think there are certain elements like a Bell test. So this is a test of the uniqueness of quantum mechanics, proving that Einstein was wrong about what he thought about quantum mechanics. This is something that I think is actually quite easy to explain and very easy to reproduce. So if you get someone proving Einstein wrong, then you've already got them to a fairly good point, and maybe they'll find their way from there.
And so you're referring to the spooky action at a distance kind of controversy that Einstein was involved with. Really. So that could be a very powerful lesson. And so how would you invoke that for somebody who's not maybe into the mathematics and the underlying physics? What would be a way to sort of get them to grok the intuitive understanding?
Yeah. So I often try to avoid the using the notion of superposition, because I think that just kind of conjures up the idea of randomness to most people. And also it's referring to something that's going on in the linear algebra. If you're not teaching people the linear algebra, you should not be using the term superposition.
Using those long words,
So I have a way of it kind of explaining how a qubit works, in which I say it's like a bit, but with a bit, all you can do is ask it whether it's zero or one. But with a qubit, there's multiple different sort of ways that you can access that information. It's almost like there's different functions you can call to ask it whether it's a zero or a one. And depending on which you choose, you'll get a different result. And then that's a starting point as you go into notions of the uncertainty principle and also the unique sorts of correlations. So actually in the Qiskit textbook, we have this interactive visual game thing. I wouldn't really call it a game, because a game has to be more fun than this is. This is unashamedly pedagogical. But it's game inspired. And that I did it. So of course I'm going to say it's good, but I think I did a fairly good job of getting people to the point where they can perform a Bell test and giving them the intuition behind it.
Yeah. Neat.
So you had mentioned that, I think, the open source textbook, that you tried to write the opening sections of that without relying on, as you say, linear algebra or other advanced math or physics concepts, right? You just sort of tried to take a conceptual approach.
Yeah, I think that usually the first thing that people do in a textbook on quantum computing is say psi equals A0 plus B1. Here is a simple equation. And most people are going to look at that and think, what? If that's a simple equation, close the book.
I'm
close
stunned.
The book. Yeah. Exactly.
So I think it's better if we start off building a little bit of intuition and then bringing in the maths. I think it's important to bring in the maths, but I think it's better when the maths is describing an intuition that people already have. And that's the starting point, rather than going straight in there.
The maths are snuck in after you have a conceptual basis to understand what
you're talking about. It's so refreshing to hear you speak this way, because I mean, I think a lot of people who actually are in math and science culture, what they often suspect is true is that many of the people operating at a high level actually do have an underlying kind of like non-rigorous, intuitive metaphor to understand the subject of study. But they don't explain that intuitive metaphor. They just go through the formality of the definitions and rigor and proof. And so it's for a lot of people, it just feels, I'm sure, refreshing to hear you, announce this kind of perspective on the material.
Yeah, I think a lot of people probably have done quite simple mechanics, so they maybe know how to multiply velocities and times and things together to do the trajectory of a ball. And even that probably seemed quite hard at the time, but at that point you knew what happened when you threw a ball.
Right.
So you had something to base your intuition on.
Right. For starters.
Yeah. That's just throwing balls. Spinning qubits, I think, is also even more good to have a intuition.
That's a really good point, because your point about superposition before, I feel like in a way, it also gives rise to the sort of fallacy of like trying all the possible answers at once, kind of the bad explanation for how qubits work. So you've done a number of sort of game jam, game hacking type of events. What are some of the things that you've seen that were sort of like super inventive ways to use quantum computing in sort of a game context?
So you have different types of game that you see in game jams. Some of them, people make a game without really thinking too much about the quantum and then just use the quantum computer as a random number generator.
Right.
And some of them are more inventive in the way they sort of approach the pedagogy. So their idea is to try and help people understand quantum computing. So this is often someone who's learning quantum computing while they're making it, and they're also finding a way within the game to teach other people and let people explore what they learn and get some idea about the simple basics of measuring in different bases or superposition or entanglement. So I think the sophisticated games are usually ones that aim to be a little bit educational. What we haven't really seen so much is people really taking the challenge of using the device. I'm going to use the device and I'm going to use it in the best way possible. That I haven't seen so much of that, but educational ones are more sophisticated.
In fact, the World Quantum Day that's coming up in, I think, mid-April, if I'm not mistaken, there's a couple of quantum educational games that are coming out of a group in the University of Chicago that look sort of, to your point, it's sort of the sophisticated game that is trying to teach a quantum principle rather than using a quantum computer to do so. You've done, I mean, like you have the quantum emoji generator, right? That's one of your projects.
Yeah. This is another thing, which is just, you don't need too much quantum computing knowledge to get experimenting. Because one thing you can do with a qubit is just use it as a bit. And so you can write a bit string on it, and that bit string could represent, by the time I had 16, a 16 qubit device to play with. So you can put 16 bits, which is enough for two ASCII characters.
Right.
And so you can write an emoticon, but you've also got superposition. So how about just superposing two emoticons for the fun?
Right.
Fun.
So, there are some of the things that even people without too much knowledge and who have only read the first couple of seconds of the Qiskit the Qiskit textbook can start playing around with.
Right.
I've also seen up on Steam, but I haven't downloaded it yet, this interesting thing called Quantum Chess. Have you heard of this this game? It sounds interesting as a powerful way to maybe illustrate some of the pedagogical ideas and still have some fun.
Yeah, so this is something that's been around for a few years. If you only know from Steam, you should check out the YouTube video in which Paul Rudd plays Stephen Hawking. This is the kind of support that Quantum Chess has
there
been.
There you go. I know. Yeah. I think it's the pinnacle of the sort of celebrity involvement in quantum computing when you at that point.
So it's a way of using superposition and entanglement in a game. So there's others, but I think that's the one that's got support.
Does that YouTube video accurately present the underlying rules of quantum chess? I mean, it sounds like it's a game of substance with real rules and consequences for your movements. It's not just some imaginary story, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think you have to play the game and look into the physics behind the game. So it's a starting point in which you can understand quantum computing. I think if people just watched the video or played the game casually, it might just seem like randomness is going on.
They might miss the point. Yeah, right. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, but there are other games that are more explicitly based on putting down quantum gates. So there's another big one coming out at the moment, which is Quantum Odyssey, where you're really putting down quantum gates and you're seeing a time evolution of the quantum computation. So that's something where even if you played it casually, you're kind of forced to understand what's going on because that's how you progress.
There's also that great Minecraft clone called Mind Test level that Jim Weaver created, which is Quantum Blocks, I think is what he called it, right? Where you're actually solving... Well, Qiskit blocks, yeah. You're actually solving puzzles by constructing gates into a circuit to produce the desired result, which I actually helped Jim, present or whatever, do a seminar with a bunch of middle schoolers in San Francisco a few years ago with that level. And it was remarkable to see 60, 70 middle schoolers sort of rip through those puzzles because they just saw it as, well, this is Minecraft. I know how to do this. There wasn't a moment where they went like, this is non-intuitive. I don't understand how this works. It was like, Minecraft, yep, got it. Boom.
Yeah.
It was great.
There's an amazing effect when you package these things up as puzzles for kids because we had this, when I was at the University of Basel, I collaborated with IBM to make Hello Quantum, which was another puzzle game based on using quantum gates, and you give it to an adult and they'll stumble. But there was one day when these kids were coming in on what was called Futures Day, and we had to teach them about quantum. They would come in for 15 minutes, I'd give them the app, they'd all just complete the app, and then they'd go off. Done. Yeah. No problem at all.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's moments like that that make me sort of, understand sort of how you bridge sort of that aspect of learning quantum with your fascination with quantum error correction, which is quantum error correction, to my mind, is one of the sort of most complicated, most challenging aspects of quantum information theory in a lot of ways, because it's the getting reliable results out of hardware that's operating at a macroscopic quantum level is so incredibly challenging. And the maths behind that are like unbelievably complicated to understand.
Even for starters, in classical, it's no nonsense math to begin with. That's base camp. You ascend from there. Right.
It's your starting point is no cloning theorem, right? So
exactly, it's like good luck. So,
easy. But I mean, it does feel like starting super early with building a quantum intuition might be the way that we end up with getting breakthrough approaches to quantum error correction. Is that sort of in the back of your mind? Yeah.
I think like a lot of techniques for quantum error correction are actually sort of sledgehammer to crack a nut. Just to keep it simple, we can make it a lot simpler for us to conceive of if we burn a whole load of physical qubits just to make one nice right. protected logical qubit. But error mitigation, as you go from the real sledgehammer to crack a nut end of quantum error correction towards error mitigation, it requires a lot more subtle effects and better understanding of the kind of dynamics that goes on in there. So that's
a crucial distinction maybe our audience is not well versed in. I mean, the difference between quantum error correction and quantum error mitigation. Would you feel comfortable doing a little dive into the distinguishing characteristics of those two subfields?
Yeah, so, well, I would say that when we design algorithms, we assume that our qubits are perfect.
Right.
And when we make qubits, they are not perfect. So there has to be something, at least in the past, there had to be a proof of principle that we could go from one to the other. We could use these imperfect qubits to make perfect qubits. And so there was a whole theoretical structure and framework of quantum error correction that was derived in order to firstly show that it could be done, but also show how it can be done. But error mitigation is more where you're taking the imperfect qubits and still trying to use them in your algorithms. But you've got to kind of find more, maybe quick and dirty ways to manage the amount of noise that's in there, or find ways to mitigate for it, or extrapolate from the noisy result that you get at the end what the real result will have been. So it's not quite so theoretical and clean and proof of principle and mathematical as quantum error correction. There's a lot of maths in it as well, though. But it's more just trying to work around the errors, whereas quantum error correction is just completely annihilate them so you don't have to think about
right. it. Really, really useful distinction. Thank you. And I've read, I don't know if it's true, please comment, is some people at least think that quantum error mitigation is probably a shorter term strategy, and that there's a lack of clarity about whether or not QEM will scale when we get to large amounts of quantum volume. And there's lots of theory on quantum error correction. It'll be relevant once we get to big scale, but we're not at that big scale yet because of engineering. So it seems like where there's two separate eras of where the best strategy will be relevant. Does that match up with your understanding?
Well, certainly, as you go into the far future, when we've got like billions of qubits, we've got more qubits than we could ever need, and we can very much just use the techniques of quantum error correction, right. which are quite expensive in terms of resource requirements.
Yes, yes.
Right now, the resource requirements are so big, we can hardly really even make one error-corrected qubits with all of the resources we have. So we're forced to use mitigation.
That very fact right there, I mean, I think many people from the outside of the quantum computing movement who are just getting involved with it, they don't understand that very basic fact about a huge limit on the space. I mean, stuff like Shor's algorithm is like a remote science fiction future until we get past that gigantic threshold. There's a long way to go before we're ready for the more serious applications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So between these two extremes, I don't know whether it's going to be sort of discrete or it's going to be continuous. So are we going to find progressively better error mitigation, which just leads us into quantum error correction, and there's not really going to be a distinction? We're going to find a path between them. Or is it going to be we struggle with error mitigation for as long as we have to, and then we're glad to be past that and we error correct everything?
right. Yeah, I guess, I mean, I wonder, when I read about mitigation strategies, it feels like some of them are engineering techniques, right? It's better fab, it's better control systems, and it's tricks, with calibration or readout techniques and that sort of thing. So that feels like, sort of the continuous evolution of the way we make qubits. But then there's the information theory side of it, where it's novel approaches to using the noisy qubits in an unexpected way that, as you say, may sustain a continuing, you know, like an ongoing novel approach to computation.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know if we talked to David Mazziotti a couple of weeks ago, and he and Sabra Case have just done this, what they call stereoscopic fingerprinting of the noise profile of specific quantum systems. And I thought that was a very interesting sort of, you know, creative approach to trying to understand holistically what the noise is on a given system, and potentially provide some strategies for mitigation.
For QEM, good point.
Yeah,
like noise is a really interesting subject, just finding out what's going on in these devices. It brings you to like another area that hobbyists might be interested in, which is the ongoing science behind even trying to build them. So with the error mitigation, I'm not sure whether you'd label things like in a circuit, you ask for a controlled knot, and there's already been a whole lot of work in making that controlled knot the best possible controlled knot it could ever be. But then on top of that, you can have tricks like, well, I want to run this circuit with these controlled knots or whatever, but I'm actually going to run two versions of it, and they're going to be slightly different, and I'm going to use some techniques to extrapolate the real noise. So that's the real result. So that's more the error mitigation. But even then, at some point, when you compile your circuit, someone else is going to be using that technique. So I suppose there's where error mitigation starts is also slightly ambiguous.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I'm very new to my studies on this topic. I'm just speculating, could it be that lots of the statistical tradecraft with respect to, analyzing data and attempting to interpret its meaning in the presence of acknowledged errors in the signal is perhaps a foundational part of QEM. Is that accurate and true?
Yeah, I think that has a role to play, especially with readout error mitigation. Because one of the biggest sources of error in the quantum computers is when you ask your qubit, are you 0 or 1? That is a big source of noise. But it's also exactly where it interfaces with the classical, where all of superpositions go away. So you can actually use quite classical techniques at that point in order to try and deduce what the real noise would have been. Mm-hmm. When things are within the actual quantumness, then I suppose it becomes a bit more ambiguous whether you can get established classical techniques to work in there. But certainly for error mitigation, you can.
Right. What are the sort of major themes that are the most interesting to you these days? You know, you tweet on a daily basis, like today on the archive in quantum error correction. Are there particular sort of trends that you see that are interesting at this point?
So there's, probably about a third of them are about error mitigation rather than error correction. And maybe a sixth, I'm just making up fractions here, are at the very, very abstract end. I think maybe a decade or a decade and a half ago, everything was at the very abstract end. People wanted to do the fancy maths to come up with fancy new error correction stuff just for the love of the mathematics. So you'd be proposing things that needed four-dimensional space in order to exist just to see what the limits were. But most of them in quantum error correction are now at a quite more of a practical level. They're looking towards the hardware. They might still be a little bit theoretical because running large-scale quantum error correction codes is still a little bit far away. But they're looking towards the hardware and have a more practical outlook, which I think is good.
I mean, it seems like one crucial characteristic of the quantum error correction puzzle is this central theorem, which, you know, it's not actually, it doesn't seem too mathy. It's the threshold theorem. I hope you agree that is a important part for people new to this space to sort of understand it. If you agree that it's important, would you attempt to explain it to us and the audience?
Yeah. So, well, thresholds within quantum error correction codes is something I can explain quite easily, I think. And that's the heart of the threshold theorem, really. So within a quantum error correcting code, you have many noisy qubits, and you're using them to build a structure in which one noiseless qubit can live. And it kind of lives, it's encoded not just in one single noisy qubit, but in collective properties of a whole bunch of them. And then you keep measuring those noisy qubits to see traces of the noise that's happening. And so this gives you hints about what's going on. And it's basically a puzzle you can solve to try and figure out where the noise was and therefore how to mitigate it. And so what you look to do is make your code ever bigger, because the bigger you make it, the more kind of detailed information you get, and the less likely it is that the hints you're getting are going to fool you in some way. Because in a very simple, very small instance, that you might get a weird little bit of noise, which looks like it's something, but it's actually something else. And that causes you to mitigate for the errors in the wrong way. But when things are bigger, then you have more information to try and work out what's going on. But also when it's bigger, you're using more noisy qubits. There's more noise going on. Everything is essentially noisier. So there's a trade-off there between how much information you're getting, how much detail you're getting about the noise, but also there's more space for things to go wrong. It's more likely that something disastrous is going to happen. And so really, which of these trade-offs wins, it depends on how strong your noise is. If your noise is very weak, if you're hardly ever seeing noise events, then the fact that bigger gives you more information and makes it harder for disastrous things to happen is going to protect you.
But adding new qubits is a net gain rather than introducing more noise.
Exactly. It makes you more protected.
Yes, yeah.
Less likely for something bad to go wrong. But if the noise is too high, then the fact just adding more stuff means you've got more entropy. There's more, you're going to have a lot more chance that something horrible is going to happen. And so as you scale up your code, you really find that if you look at the probability that something horrible is going to go wrong, it becomes a step function where if your noise is over a threshold, then it's just something bad is going to happen. Just give up. And if it's below the threshold, then you're fine. You're going to find a way to mitigate for that error.
You can keep adding more qubits and get to better and better accuracy.
Yeah. So if you then take this, because this here I'm just really talking about one encoded qubit sitting there doing nothing other than feeling noise. Of course, you also need to do gates. You need to take these encoded qubits and interact them with each other and do everything you need for an algorithm. So once you build all of that in as well, you get then the notion of a threshold generalized to the entirety of quantum computing. But still, it's as long as you're below a certain noise, then everything is going to be fine. And so that was an important thing to prove back in the day, because it showed that there was a finite value of noise that we can cope with. And in the first proofs, that value was like 10 to the minus 20 or something stupid, because they were just really trying to prove that it was finite.
Right.
Since then, we've gotten a lot higher, such that noise levels now are approaching what we believe the threshold to be.
Right.
But that's kind of the threshold.
Who were some of the researchers involved in that initial theoretical proof that it was finite?
Those names don't come to mind. I know the person who has it has the same name as another person who's famous. So it's a doubly famous name that should be at the forefront of my head.
But it's funny. Yeah.
And so what is the current math result in terms of the threshold of error occurrence that you need to get to get over the hump?
Yeah. Well, now we're looking at sort of the percent level. It depends on code and decoders and
one or 2%. Yeah.
But it's a sort of percent level, not the 10 to the minus something.
Right. Yeah, that seems unachievable by any remotely feasible current engineering. Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Well, I said that it does provide a little ray of hope around the progress on the engineering.
Absolutely.
Front. I mean, if the theory says that you could get it down to 1%, it sounds like at least some of the people on the engineering side see a route towards getting to that outcome.
Yeah. So we seem to be on route for it. And also, there have been experimental results already where people have built minimal examples of quantum error correcting codes and shown that they have a beneficial effect. So that's what happens when the noise is low enough.
Right, right. I think Ken Brown actually led a group that implemented a Bacon-Shor on a trapped ion system. I think it may have been Sandia's research system, possibly, if I'm not mistaken. But Ken also, in conversation with Ken, I remember him saying, every year they say it's not possible, and every year we get a little bit closer. So,
fun.
He's been at it for a while.
Also, IBM Quantum, there was an experiment which I think went out last year. And also, more recently, the Valrath group, ATH, more local to me, did a surface code.
Right.
So usually it's always some sort of code that's easy to fit on the devices people have, like the Bacon-Shor code or the particular instance that was used in IBM Quantum. But to see a 17-qubit surface code, the kind of thing that us theorists love to see because it's kind of simple, that was... very nice.
Cool. And can you describe what you mean by surface code? Because I've heard that term thrown around, but I confess I don't fully understand what that means.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing research based on the surface code now for like a decade and a half.
Yeah.
So can I give you a short answer?
Well, less than a decade and a half long, maybe.
Yeah.
Wish we had the time. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, initial examples of quantum error correcting codes didn't really think about the practicalities of how your qubits were able to talk to each other. But there are certain codes now which are usually within a class called topological codes, where your qubits are imagined to be sitting on a two-dimensional surface and they only have to talk to their neighbors. And so they're a way to do quantum error correction within those constraints.
Mm.
And the surface code is a classic example of this. You typically think of your qubits sitting on a square lattice and they're talking to their neighbors. And so half of your qubits are just sitting there talking to each of their neighbors and seeing if they've seen an error, and then you measure them to see if there's an error around. So that's the basic idea.
You're using entanglement to reflect whether the actual data qubit has been affected by an error. If it has been affected by an error, the error would show up in one of these entangled ancilla qubits. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, and how much is entanglement needed? It's kind of, so you can you can think of a version of the surface code which only looks for bit flip errors, and that requires no entanglement.
Oh, I see.
And there's a version in which it only looks for phase flip errors, and there you need a lot of superposition, but it also doesn't need entanglement.
Okay.
But if you want to do both of those at the same time, you can. They work perfectly well with each other. But as soon as you do that, then the only way that the system can support taking all of that information at the same time is to be in an entangled state.
Right.
And I guess for our audience, that's a crucial point is the two aspects of sources of error within quantum computation, right? Is the bit flip and phase error. Both have to be accounted for. That's very distinct from classical computing. Are there any other types of errors that somehow quantum error correction has to struggle with, or are those the two main concerns?
Yes and no. Well, okay, so there are a huge amount of... this is another thing that I could probably go on too long about. I think I like to think of quantum computing as kind of a mixture of continuous and discrete computing. So the wave particle duality of quantum becomes continuous discrete duality. And so we have continuous errors, which are a thing that is awful in analog computers, but we have error correction kind of discretizes them. So everything turns into bit flip errors and phase flip errors. Even if it's something very discrete and weird, quantum evolution, it'll turn into bit flip errors and phase flip errors, unless it's a loss error, which is the kind of the other type, and that is your qubit disappears.
Right.
Do you mean decoherence in that particular?
So it depends on what your qubit is. So one way is, I'm kind of talking your qubit physically disappears is one way. If you've got photonic qubits, they might actually fly off in the wrong direction.
Right.
For the kind of things that we have at IBM Quantum, we isolate the lowest two levels of an anharmonic oscillator. But there are other levels. And if it decides it wants to go up into them, then it's not a qubit anymore.
Effectively,
you write it off.
It's kind of gone.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's interesting. What do you call that particular error?
Well, so that's a leakage error.
Leakage. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. So it leaks out of the space that it's supposed to be in.
Wow. This is fun. I love this detail, and lots of the most interesting topics we come across. The speaker wants to go on for a long time, so don't hesitate. But I'm glad you're able to be concise. So thank you. Hey, I saw recently, you probably are watching this way more carefully than I am. I think it was a Nature paper announcing some new qubit architecture. I think it was on raw silicon chips, where they were able to do enough proof of concept around running that qubit in that architecture beneath the error threshold that people were concerned around the threshold theorem. Am I remembering that correctly?
So there's been a lot of research recently in silicon spin qubits, and you want to show that you can do a controlled knot that is good enough to be below the threshold.
Yes.
Silicon spin qubits are quite far behind a lot of other approaches at the moment, in that when you're demonstrating a two-qubit gate, you've probably only got two qubits.
Right.
So it's not quite the same as when you've got a 127-qubit system and you're showing you've got two-qubit gates on there. But that is... showing that you can get a good two qubit gates on two qubits is the stepping stone to more.
Right.
So actually, some of the work I do is looking into alternative qubit architectures. And so we're also looking at silicon spin qubits ourselves. So yeah, that was a big day in silicon spin qubits when that paper dropped.
Pretty cool.
I guess that's where superconducting qubits were in 97 or 98, I think, or something like that, 99, the two qubits.
Yeah. A transmon, I think, is much more recent than that even.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
This difference between transmons and silicon spin qubits is huge at the moment. A transmon being a kind of superconducting qubit, that is. But maybe 20 years down the line, then things will look.
That's what keeps the field really interesting, though.
No doubt.
There's so much.
Always the possibility
so much innovation
of black
going
swan.
On.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, I don't mind where my qubits come from, as long as they present good, interesting problems from an error correction perspective. So that's why I'm happy to work on transmons and on silicon spin qubits.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Interesting.
That's great. Excellent, James. Well, I recognize we're nearing the end of our time. Is there anything related to any of the topics we've discussed that you want to touch on before we close out?
No, I think there's nothing sticking in my mind that I wish I said blah, blah, blah. Because I usually say blah, blah, blah.
I wanted to give you an opportunity to interject one last blah, 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 if you wanted to.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, I really do want to thank you. I think that the contributions you've made to the teaching materials, the learning materials, and just the ideas around making quantum computing accessible to hobbyists and to to, you know, newcomers, I think is all extremely valuable for the community overall. And it's great stuff. And I've enjoyed a lot of the stuff you've done. So thank you very much.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Very fun conversation. Great blend of topics, right? The pedagogy and the gaming and this deeper theory on EC. So really, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, it was good talking to you.
That was fun. I really like how James talks about almost building a hacker community or bringing the hacker community into the quantum technologies community, because, you know, as a sign of vitality and sort of harkening back to the early days of Silicon Valley and the internet and the dot-com boom, I think that there's a lot of merit to bringing in those really or attracting those really creative, intelligent sort of problem solvers into a new space. And that, you know, feeds into his sort of interest in education and pedagogy, which I think are extremely important topics. It doesn't really make sense to build a new technology if you don't actually have people who know how to use it. So education is key.
Key. So agree. I think also just another theme that just keeps coming up in these interviews, right, that I think is noteworthy is all this stuff around, you know, new ways to think about types of analysis of error and accuracy. It's not just T1 times and T2 times and bit flip errors and phase errors. I mean, that's just the base camp. There's so much more out there. And so, I mean, you know, new types of errors and new frameworks of analysis that you can use to control for, I think is a rich topic. I mean, huge research frontiers out there, but also a great way to see with clarity what's really going on with the current crop of vendors. So that was pretty cool to hear all that dialogue about so-called quantum computing leakage errors. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're so grateful. Thank you, James. If you're listening to this recording, for your time, but I hope you, the audience, enjoyed as much as we did this guided tour of these new facets of QC research and education. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, that's it for this episode of The New Quantum Era, a podcast by Sebastian Hassinger and Kevin Roney. Our cool theme music was composed and played by Omar Costa Hamida. Production work is done by our wonderful team over at PodFi. If you are at all like us and enjoy this rich, deep, and interesting topic, please subscribe to our podcast on whichever platform you may stream from. And even consider, if you like what you've heard today, reviewing us on iTunes and or mentioning us on your preferred social media platforms. We're just trying to get the word out on this fascinating topic and would really appreciate your help spreading the word and building community. Thank you so much for your time.